You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on Monocle Radio on the 12th of January, 2024. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme, the Houthis vow US and UK airstrikes on their positions in Yemen will not go without punishment or retaliation.
ونحن بذلك أكثر عزما على مواصلة المشوار واستهداف السفن المرتبطة بإسرائيل.
As voters in Taiwan make up their minds as they prepare to go to the polls on Saturday morning, how will Beijing respond? Israel mounts its defence at the ICJ in The Hague. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak travels to Ukraine to announce Britain's largest annual military support package since Russia's illegal invasion. And with awards season now in full flow, we'll get the latest entertainment news with Laura Kramer.
I'll be talking about the Emmys, Thailand's investment in foreign film and TV production, and a European vote appeal that could shake up a swift surge in youth turnout.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. Shipping firms, including Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd, have welcomed US and UK airstrikes on 16 Houthi targets in Yemen overnight in an attempt to resecure the crucial Red Sea route. But the Iran-backed group has pledged to continue its attacks on shipping vessels and retaliate on the US and UK. Jean-Louis Samin is a senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore Middle East Institute. Jean, firstly, what more do we know about these attacks and how significant were they on the Houthis' operations?
What we know so far is that, as mentioned in the communique from the White House, these were limited strikes. This is not about the US or the UK entering the Yemen war. We don't know yet exactly how precise, how specific they were to degrade the military power of the Houthis. And I doubt that these strikes on their own can really make a difference in terms of the firepower of the Houthis. So unfortunately, I don't think this is the end of this type of tit-for-tat attacks that we see, that we've seen over the last weeks between the US-led coalition and Houthis.
There will obviously be a lot of planning on this and research of the sites being used to launch these attacks. Do you think, though, this was the first night? Will we see several nights of these responses?
Well, I think at the moment, the US is hoping that this sends a message, this sends a strong message to both the Houthis and also the Iranian regime, which is behind the arsenal of the Houthis. A lot of the drones, the missiles that the Houthis have been using were provided with the support of the Iranians. So at the moment, I believe that the White House is hoping that this is a wave of strikes to de-escalate, in a sense, the conflict. But if we look at the history, there's no clear evidence that these type of strikes, limited by design, have been able to deter further escalation with the Houthis. So we'll have to see in the coming days, maybe coming hours, if the Houthis retaliate against targets in the Red Sea.
And what's the reaction been in the region from countries, particularly, of course, Saudi Arabia?
It's a very complex situation because the Saudi Arabia, before the war in Gaza started, was in a process of negotiating a ceasefire with the Houthis. After years of conflict in Yemen, the Saudi government came to the realization that it could not win on the battlefield. So was coming to the realization it has to find a trade-off with the Houthis. So it was accepting the idea of letting the Houthis in Yemen. Now, the Saudis are in a difficult spot. They do not explicitly support the U.S. coalition because they fear that this would only create a new momentum for the war. They were on their way to leave Yemen, and they fear that this will only drag all the region again into the conflict. So it's a very complex situation. It doesn't mean that the Saudis are supporting the Houthi actions. It just means that they doubt that the U.S. approach so far is the right one to address the issue.
But is there not sort of recognition in the region from neighbors that this sea route needs to be cleared? I mean, it's not just Western economies, European economies that rely on it. Many countries in the region also rely on it for safe shipping of goods coming from Asia. And if it's not resecured, it's going to add huge prices for the shipment of goods, and that'll increase inflation once again.
Yes, for sure. I would say that there are conflicted views on what's going on at the moment. Clearly, the economic logic is compelling, at least for the governments in the region. But at the same time, if you look at the Houthi rhetoric at the moment, they are trying to convey the message that they are supporting the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So they're leveraging the frustration in the public opinion in the Arab world, and they actually use the last strikes from the US and the UK to show that this is the convenient narrative that this is a war between the West and Israel against the Arabs. I don't think this is at the moment an effective narrative, but this is something that you will see more and more in the coming days in the Arab, information sphere and in the social networks. So this is why I say there are conflicted views at the moment. Mm.
Other nations, we understand, including Canada, Australia, the Netherlands and Bahrain, provided support in this mission. Do we know what exactly they did? And does that show that there is, outside of the region, quite a broad consensus on protecting maritime security?
As far as I know, we don't have the details, the operational details on or the division of labor between all these countries. We can assume that the local partners, in particular Bahrain, provided, operational facilities. You have the US and the UK having their own military bases in Bahrain. So those were probably used for the operational decision making. With regards to the other countries, and in particular the Europeans or the Canadians, this is mostly logistics, intelligence, but this is also a diplomatic support after all. It's not really, at the end of the day, those countries that make a difference at the military level. And the one that is the most decisive one here is obviously the U.S. So the idea of all these countries together, I think it's also sending a message from the White House that the White House and the U.S., by extension, is not alone in that mission, that this is not just the U.S. unilaterally attacking an Arab organization.
Russia has called for a meeting at the UN to discuss the strikes, but will China be aligned with them on this, as a lot of these vessels are shipping Chinese goods and the flow is crucial for their economy?
Yes, and in a way, if you look at the share of Chinese oil imports from the Gulf compared to the oil imports of the US from the Gulf, the Chinese have much more to lose from what's happening at the moment. So if we were in a rational process, the Chinese would be supporting what's going on with the U.S. Having said that, we've seen since the war in Gaza started a very reluctant position of the Chinese government that is not comfortable with the conflict in the Middle East. And what's happening is going against its own narrative that it conveys to its partners in the region, which is a narrative which could be summarized as an anti-Western narrative, the idea that most of the issues in the region come from the Western assertiveness, and the type of operation that the U.S. launched yesterday would go into that type of narrative. So again, we see conflicted views at the moment. It will be very interesting, very important to see how China reacts in the coming days, possibly at the UN Security Council level.
Jean-Luc, thank you. That was Jean-Luc Sama. Now here's Tom Webb with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. Myanmar's army has agreed a ceasefire with an alliance of rebel groups in the north of the country after talks mediated by China. Beijing had grown concerned as fighting in Myanmar spread closer to the country's shared border. Year-on-year inflation in Argentina surged past 200% in 2023, according to new data, its highest level since the early 1990s. The South American country has been battered by decades of economic crisis, which new libertarian President Javier Milei vowed to resolve with dramatic spending cuts. Tens of thousands of people have demonstrated in Poland against the arrest and imprisonment of two former ministers. Crowds also gathered in protest against the government's changes to state media. The rallies come amid tensions between the country's new pro-European government and its populist president. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Tom. After months of campaigning, voters in Taiwan are set to vote tomorrow in the island nation's presidential elections. However, with polling banned for the 10 preceding days, it's unclear where the momentum is going. Wen Ti-sung is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global China Hub and joins us now from Taipei. Wen Ti, thank you for coming on the show with us today. Firstly, how has the last day of campaigning been?
Hi, thank you for having me. Last day, a lot of excitement, a lot of energy on the ground for sure. This happened after an almost year-long campaign. There's so much pent-up emotional energy. I think voters just can't wait for tomorrow to come where they get to cast a vote and just express their passion.
And whilst polling is banned currently, are there any indicators to help us predict the outcome at all?
Yes, so Taiwan's legal framework forbids publication of polling about 10 days before the election. So really what we have to go on is to look at what kind of campaign messaging the campaigns put out, whether they're trying to appeal to more moderate swing voters or whether they're trying to come out with more, I guess, more party line messages, one that can be good for mobilizing turnout from the party loyalists. So if we go by that indicator, then we likely see the latter a lot more. KMT, the historical opposition party, talk a lot more about maintaining cross-strait peace as a priority. And the ruling party, DPP, again, doubles down on messages about the importance of US-Taiwan ties and how deterrence should be the primary vehicle with which Taiwan pursues to managing tensions with China, rather than, let's say, diplomatic accommodation, rather than other ways to have wishful thinking, if you will, about China's goodwill in this situation.
And finally, I understand you're observing campaign rallies. It sounds like there is a lot going on there. If you can just finally tell us, Beijing has been ramping up its interference this week, accused of running conspiracy theory-laden disinformation campaigns and invading your airspace with a spy balloon. What is the feeling on this night about China and the future relationship? And what do you think Beijing's reaction will be to the result?
Yeah, so Beijing's reaction will really depend on which political party that wins the presidency after the election, and also on who is going to win the majority in the legislature, which is going to happen on the same day. You're going to have an election for both presidency and the legislature. So if the ruling party, DPP, manages to get reelected into a third term, what is going to happen likely is that Beijing will try to show its displeasure at the results. So you are going to see military and economic implications. Military will be amping up pressure around Taiwan Strait, like, for example, China just launched a satellite near Taiwan a couple of days ago, for example. After the election, likely going to be more POA, Chinese military jets, and warships in Taiwan's vicinity. And economically, I think we kind of see that Beijing would try to drive home this message that not getting along with Beijing will carry significant economic punishment and will deny Taiwan access to China's business market. So China, for example, has threatened to suspend a number of tariffs and free trade arrangements that it has with Taiwan, and that it has also promised to review some of the existing arrangements that's in place. So should a candidate that Beijing doesn't like get into power, I think that's going to be bad news for some of the Taiwanese Jesus people who are trying to explore the mainland Chinese market.
Wen Tisung in Taipei, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Vincent McAvinney, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. To The Hague now, where the UN's top court, the International Court of Justice, has been responding to South Africa's case, where Israel, sorry, has been responding to South Africa's case, claiming it's perpetrating genocide in Gaza. On Thursday, South Africa argued that Israel violated the 1948 Genocide Convention by planning to destroy Gaza from the highest level of the state. This morning, Israel has defended its military campaign in response to the October 7th attacks, stating it is not attempting to destroy the Palestinian people and that South Africa's version of events is grossly distorted. Alison Kaplan-Summer is a journalist with Haaretz and joins us now from Tel Aviv. Alison, can you take us through Israel's arguments this morning at the court?
Sure. Hi. Thanks for having me on. So basically, Israel, you know, confronted their legal team, their British head attorney, and they also had speaking legal advisors to the foreign ministry and the deputy attorney general in the justice ministry. Their case is that, you know, it's an absurd and grossly distorted story if you're going to try to characterize Israel's attempt to defend itself and to preserve its security against Hamas aggression and twist that into some sort of intentional genocidal campaign aimed at wiping out the Palestinian population. Pretty systematically, they pointed to the differences between intentional genocide, as has been defined in the court in the past, and what Israel is trying to do, which is a declared intention to try to root out the Hamas military infrastructure, which was responsible for the October 7th attacks, in a very complicated situation in which much of that infrastructure is located in, among, and below a civilian population. And it pointed to the many ways and behaviors in which the Israel is conducting its war that that negate any kind of accusation of genocide and justify some sort of provisional measures to be taken against Israel.
And South Africa drew some of the public comments by the sort of far-right members of the governing coalition into the court yesterday. The sort of talk about clearing Gaza, about other nations taking on the population and about potentially having settlers live in Gaza. Has it been seen in Israel as, you know, an error for those kind of comments to be made because they're being now exploited, even though that isn't the official view of the government or the majority of the Israeli people? They have now been used against you in this court case as a sort of intent behind the actions.
I mean, absolutely. To put it in really blunt terms, I think the vast, vast majority of Israelis would like these ministers in the government to keep their mouths shut. In more polite language, Israel's attorney in the ICJ, Mr. Shaw, said, quote, "To produce random quotes which are not in conformity with government policy is misleading at best." And indeed, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made a point of declaring that, you know, what is being stated by his ministers, these extreme right-wing ministers that he needs to keep in his government in order to stay in power, does not represent Israeli policy. And so the Israel's defenders in the court pointed out standing orders that are in the IDF to differentiate between military and civilian targets, the numerous remarks by Netanyahu and by the defense minister declaring that the goal of the war is to destroy Hamas, Hamas and not targeting the Palestinian people. So they've been pointing to remarks made by people who are actually making the decisions as far as prosecuting that war, and the behavior of the IDF as negating the importance of some of these like horrible extreme statements that are being made by these far extreme right wing senior ministers. But if you're asking what Israelis would like, they would have liked those remarks not to be made at all.
And what's the feeling inside of Israel at some of the claims made by South Africa yesterday, and the fact that, you know, despite the country trying to get this case dismissed, genocide has a very significant and terrible position in the history of Jewish people around the world, in thinking back to events of the Second World War. But the fact that now in such a multinational platform and being played out live on television, Israel is now the one that's being accused of this.
Well, you know, as some of the lawyers said, you know, if you're going to point to every country that is attempting to defend itself or to fight against a country that attacked them, and Hamas did attack Israel, if you want to color that as genocide, that's a very dangerous precedent to set, because that means that any terrorist group can launch some sort of horrible attack against any country, you know, go in and try to kill and murder thousands of its citizens. And then every time a country tries to strike back at those people, it's going to be accused of being genocidal. So it muddies the waters between a conflict, a horrible military conflict in which there are many civilian casualties, which everyone regrets and is sorry about, and Israel says that it does its best to reduce and keep to a minimum, and actual genocide, which is very dangerous in terms of being able to battle, you know, actual genocidal campaigns, of which you can say that what Israel is doing is horrible and terrible and you object to it and you want a ceasefire, but I don't think you can point to it and call it genocide.
Alison Kaplan-Sommer, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has made an unannounced visit to Ukraine this morning to announce a military support package worth £2.5 billion, the UK's largest since the outbreak of war. He's also set to sign a new agreement supporting its long-term security. Alex Koshchorov is a Russia-Ukraine analyst at S&P Global Market Intelligence. Alex, thank you for joining us. Firstly, what's in this multi-billion pound package and how significant is it?
Well, it is significant because it's larger than the previous package, which had been delivered by the United Kingdom by about £200 million. So it's an increase which is important to Ukraine, especially at the time when there are concerns about continued Western military support, particularly from the United States. It will include various things, including weapons and ammunition. Reportedly, there will be, it will include various UAVs and potentially USVs, and also missiles, which are important for Ukraine as the warfare is becoming increasingly long-based and focused on long-range attacks far beyond the front lines. There has been very little territorial change in the past year along the front lines. Russia managed to achieve some net gains of about 63 square kilometers, which is 0.01% of Ukrainian total territory, which is fundamentally a stalemate. So Ukraine is trying to acquire these types of weapons, which would allow it to strike on Russian military and infrastructure assets far beyond the front lines. And so what was announced today is clearly important.
And how does the UK compare to the current level of support from the EU and the US, where it does seem that things are slightly faltering?
Yes, there is a lot of uncertainty about, what's going to happen to the U.S. support. Overall, support from EU member states combined has been actually higher than that from the United States. United Kingdom plays a significant role, as well as Norway and Canada. These countries are outside of all these countries are outside of EU, but they are all in NATO. There is still a lot of NATO coordination happening around this. And I think what's important now is that we see more Western countries committing to supporting Ukraine at the time when there is uncertainty over the continued U.S. support. Ukrainian President Zelensky was in the Baltic states just several days ago, and these countries have committed their military support to Ukraine, and even small countries such as Estonia.
I want to come to the US in a minute, but Rishi Sunak will also, we understand, sign a security cooperation agreement with President Zelensky. What is that agreement about?
It is about longer-term security cooperation and support, which would probably include intelligence sharing and increased training in terms of long-range reconnaissance and the use of British naval expertise to assist Ukrainians to defend the their maritime border against the Russian threat, and to neutralize the threat from the Russian Black Sea Fleet, which, you know, has been quite decimated over the past year by Ukrainian attacks. So it will include various aspects. I think intelligence sharing will be probably critical. But again, a lot of this is signaling continued Western support to Ukraine, which is especially important as this uncertainty over the U.S. Continued support is still there.
On that point, the Iowa caucus is set to take place on Monday. It seems from all the polling that Donald Trump is going to storm it, and that he is likely once again to be the Republican candidate, unless he is caught up in one of these court cases that could scupper him. But he has made it clear that he, is not interested in the US's role in the world. His former advisor, John Bolton, has said he thinks that Trump will categorically pull out of NATO, that he won't give support to Ukraine. How much concern is there in Kyiv and around Ukraine about that possibility now of Trump returning?
I'm not a US analysts, so I won't be going into discussions over the US election. There is concern. This concern is not only limited to Kyiv, but also to other capitals in Europe, including especially the NATO member states on the eastern flank of NATO, including Baltic states, Poland, Romania, Finland. So there is concern, of course. And I think that's why, the measures which are being undertaken by some smaller states, including Baltic states, but also the United Kingdom, are particularly important because they demonstrate and they signal that the Western countries still support Ukraine. We need to remember that the US election is taking place in November, and that the change of administration will be happening in January next year. So there's still, 2024 ahead of us. And there are still concerns about whether US support to Ukraine will continue in 2024. I think there is lack of clarity on this right now. Mm. At the same time, there is quite a lot of Republican lawmakers in the United States are supportive of Ukraine, and they have publicly expressed their support to continued assistance being delivered to Ukraine, because they understand that the risks and threats which emanate from Russia are not going away if the United States stops supporting Ukraine.
Alex Kokarov is a Russia-Ukraine analyst at S&P Global Market Intelligence. Thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Well, it is 12:29 in London and 4:29 a.m. in Hollywood. Finally today, our producer and entertainment correspondent Laura Kramer is with me in the studio for a look at the day's film and culture headlines. It is the time, the special season.
It is the special season and a good excuse to play one of my favorite clips of all time.
What is your favorite season? Awards.
That was, of course, Moira Rose on Schitt's Creek.
That's right. So we are in knee deep in awards season right now because this weekend we have two very exciting award shows. So we've got the Emmys on Monday. That's, well, Sunday, actually. It'll be Monday, our time, that we find out all the winners.
And these are delayed because of the strikes.
And then the day before that, we also have the Critics' Choice Awards ceremony. That's also happening. Now, the Emmys will be interesting because it seems like we might see a replay of what happened at the Golden Globes earlier this week, which is that people are assuming Succession is going to walk away with all the major awards. Mm-hmm. Are you excited for this? Do you want that to happen?
I mean, it was a great... I think when you look at shows in the last 10 years, the one that really stuck the landing was Succession. I think particularly compared to the likes of, you know, Game of Thrones and some others. So I think that they are just fine. And they are all strong and quite unique performances.
Yeah, and a lot of them actually, for example, in the drama actor category, it's a lot of the same actors from that same show going up against one another. Mm. And right now the prediction is that Kieran Culkin is actually going to win over that award, but we'll see what actually happens.
Who I think is in the male lead category is the most justified for his work on that season. I mean, you know, when you think about his performance in the bottle episode on the boat when they find out about their father and at the funeral as well, it was an incredible performance, way stronger than his brother. I can't remember the actor's
Jeremy
name.
Jeremy Strong,
you know, all that method acting nonsense. Like, it just, yeah, it's, yeah, it will be interesting to see. What else are we tipping for big awards at the Emmys shows wise?
Well, a lot of stuff is actually being awarded from streamers. So there are 27 awards that are potentially that are nominated from streamers. And if you think about it, just 6 years ago, that was only 10. So we're really seeing a lot of streaming shows. One show that I don't know how well it's going to do, but I'm very excited for it because it's one of my favorites. White Lotus is also up for a few of them. Mm-hmm. Now, very exciting news. As you may have read, we are getting more news about the third season of
Some
White Lotus.
Casting news coming out. Yeah.
That's right. It's very highly anticipated. So we're hearing that Leslie Bibb is going to be part of the cast, as well as Jason Isaacs and Parker Posey, whom I absolutely love. I know you are a fan of You've Got Mail. She's in that.
She's in that, but I don't really know her from anything else. But her name is very recognizable for some reason.
She's also in Best in Show, and that was actually with Jennifer Coolidge, who was in the first two seasons of White Lotus. So mm-hmm. very exciting. Now, the third season is going to be starting production. It's assumed actually in February. So this, okay. Again, another one of those shows that was pushed back due to the pandemic. And it's going to be filmed in Thailand, which is very, very exciting. Obviously, beautiful nature, lots of culture, history in the country.
And it's going to look at spirituality, we're told,
that's
this
right.
time.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, that's going to be kind of the theme that they're going up. Talking about potentially maybe a yogi who's very spirit. We'll see. I'm very excited for it, I have to say.
Yeah, okay.
Now,
definitely.
What's fun
I think
about-
the next season, though, should be like ski resort based. I think that okay. is a prime location.
Somewhere cold.
I think we've done like sunny ones now. I
okay.
think we need to go somewhere cold next. Well, I'm just thinking of Gwyneth Paltrow ski trip again, as a way.
I think that just needs to be a drama on its own. Yeah. It is interesting, though, because they have paired up with the Department of Thai Tourism, and they are really investing a lot in foreign productions. They want to get people over there. They want this money to come into the country and also to promote the country to tourists. So they're offering up to a 20% cash rebates for productions that qualify. And one of those qualifications is basically spending more than $4 million in the country on film productions.
And those kind of policies work. If you look at the UK film production in the last 20 years, essentially since the onset of the Harry Potter movies, where J.K. Rowling insisted that they were made here with British crews and British actors, the UK government, Labour at the time, brought in all these tax rules for film production. And now you get, you know, a lot of Star Wars movies, a lot of Marvel movies, a lot of big movies are actually shot here in the UK, in studios and around the UK, Game of Thrones in Northern Ireland. This can be a really huge boost to the economy, isn't it?
It could be, but let's hope that, unlike with the Marvel films, they don't get the tube stops wrong, because I know as a Londoner...
I mean specifically Thor 2, as someone who lives in Greenwich, the idea that you can go from embankment in central London to Greenwich on a line in about 5 minutes. I mean,
let's hope they do that better. but now we have to move on to probably the biggest story of the week that I've seen kind of in entertainment. Yeah. I mean, the European Commission Vice President Margarita Schingas is urging Taylor Swift to encourage young people to vote in the upcoming European election in June. Now, he believes that she has the ability to mobilize the youth vote. And as it so happens, she will be in Europe around that time on the European leg of her Eras tour.
Yeah, I will be going to that tour. I'm delighted to say it's going to be one of the highlights of the year. But this is really interesting because in the Miss Americana documentary she made, which was with Netflix, it's still on there. It's a really fascinating documentary. It follows kind of her reputation era time into the kind of Lover era. So this was post the Kim and Kanye fixed audio, edited audio tape. She was also coming under flack for not having waded in the 2016 election. She only posted, I think, just her I voted sticker on the day of the election. And she explicitly says, I regret not speaking out. And you see her having arguments with her father and management about not having stood up to Trump. She has since got very involved in US politics, made her feelings clear, because she was being used as a kind of rallying pole for the sort of far right, very kind of, you know, Aryan kind of ideal. And she wasn't aware of that, she admitted, and has pushed back on it. She's got involved not just with presidential stuff, but also local state stuff. So do you think she might be minded to get involved in Europe?
It's interesting because I think that while she has been getting more involved in politics, I do think that they also very heavily think about the implication of every single thing that she's going to do, because that's the magnitude of her star right now. So she did ask some people to register and vote. And within hours, you know, she's got close to 300 million Instagram followers, more than 35,000 people registered. So she did get involved. She also got involved in the midterm elections. Actually, the person she supported at that time didn't go on to win the election. I think that while they she does more political involvement now, I think it is still very heavily curated. And I don't personally see why she would speak out about the European elections.
Yeah, and also a complicated picture across all those member states to say. She might, though, encourage people to actually sign up to vote, because engagement in democracy is kind of good to promote anywhere, I guess. But Laura Kramer, thank you very much. Watch this space. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Lillian Fawcett and Tom Webb. Our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.